In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to a little bonus edition of Scottish Blethers. It should be episode 75, but as we've already recorded a 75, we're making this 74B for bonus. And what's the special occasion, Helen?
Well, we've just had a major, major triumph. Mm-hmm. The Scottish women have won gold at the Winter Olympics in curling.
Yeah, the only British gold, I might say. But the team, the ladies' team of curlers, were entirely Scottish. And also the men came runners-up earlier on the few hours earlier. They were silver medal, a bit of a disappointment for them because they were hot favourites. But we're here to celebrate the fantastic triumph of Eve Muirhead's team. It's called Team Muirhead because it's called after the skip. And the skip is the head one of the four curlers that go out and compete on the ice.
Yeah, they really, it was nip and tuck and touch and go for quite some time. But they wiped out the Japanese in the final.
Well, they did. I mean, it was very hard won, particularly for Eve Muirhead herself, because this was her fourth attempt for a gold medal. And she's gone through real hardship. She's had treatment on arthritis in her hip. So, you know, she was really gunning for this. And the men had been hot favourites and they had narrowly been pipped by Sweden, who they'd beaten earlier in one of the previous rounds. Yeah. But that was a real nip and tuck when it went to an extra end. But when the ladies came out on Saturday morning, early in the hours of Saturday morning here, it was a decisive victory, I think you could say.
Yes, it was unbelievable. 10-3, I think it was, in the final. But what I found that curling itself has become very much a favourite. I'm going to be a bit rude, but see, it was kind of an old manny sport at one time. But now it's really, in the last 20, maybe 25, 30 years, it's become very much a sport that young people have gone into.
I think the Olympics have had a lot to do with that. Yes. Since it became an Olympic sport in 2018, lots of people love to watch it. And there's a good reason why it's called chess on ice, because it is very much a game of strategy.
Oh, yeah. And it's, even when you know nothing about the game, when you watch it, you can actually see the strategy unfolding. It's very interesting to see that.
Yeah, so people get hooked on it and we get lots of videos made of people playing curling in their lounge in their kitchen and all the rest of it. But then they lose interest for the rest of the year. So we thought we would go into a little bit about the background to curling, because it very much is a Scottish sport. We claim it anyway.
Well, yes, well, we claim a lot of things, but curling definitely was. There seems to be some evidence to suggest that it was in Scotland quite early on in the 1500s, I think it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much like golf. There was very strong trade links between the Baltic countries and the Low Countries and Germany, and they developed similar games. And so we all claim that this was developed in our own country. But we do have some documented evidence of early curling.
That's right. Apparently, the first written evidence is of a contest using stones on ice. So we can assume it must have been similar to curling. Comes from the records of all places, Paisley Abbey. And that was in February 1541. And then we've got the two 16th century paintings as well.
Yeah, that was Peter Bruegel, who showed that curling, the game of curling, was being played in the Netherlands at that time. So as I say, it was definitely taken across the North Sea by merchants and traders, yeah. I suppose, that were going backwards and forwards. But we do claim to have the first curling club in the world, just very similar to golf. We have Kilsyth Curling Club, which was formally constituted in 1716. Still going today.
That's amazing. And they apparently lay claim to the oldest purpose-built curling pond in the world.
Yeah. So it's just like golf, you know, that the idea that people would pick up a stick and hit a stone on the ground, it's the same. Most villages would have had a pond.
And if you go, not necessarily in the central belt here, but up in the Highlands, a lot of the old hotels that are, you know, that were probably old houses at one estate, houses, manor houses at one time, and are now into hotels. If you look carefully at the ground, especially maybe the weather that we've had, Liz, where there's been snow, a thin covering of snow, you can see the indentations where the curling pond would have been.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Larbert, and up in the what became Belsdyke Hospital was always Larbert Pond. And when it froze over in the wintertime, everybody was up there either for the skating or for the curling. And you go around the Highland villages, they've all got their curling ponds. I don't know if you've been to the Highland Folk Museum in Newton Moor.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because there they've not only got the curling pond, but they've actually got the I don't know what they call it, the clubhouse, where the people would gather before. And you can see the old stones and the old boots and brushes that they would use for the game.
I mean, it really is quite fascinating. And the thing about these curling ponds, what was that they were normally quite shallow, so they froze and they were very safe to go on, the ones that were purpose-built curling ponds.
Yeah, and I think it's a sign of global warming that we just don't get the ice freezing as it did. So nowadays, most of the games played indoors in ice rinks. And of course, you have to compete with the other users of the ice rink. And so traditionally, curling would have been done deep into the night. So I always remember my father going out about 10 o'clock at night to go to the ice rink to play curling.
Well, that's right. And now I think it's things like ice hockey that go on deep into the night, because I think curlers appear to be able to get either purpose-built rinks built for themselves, or they are more willing to be given space during the day.
Yeah, but there's certain parts of Scotland down where, you know, the indication of that comes in where the girls came from on Saturday, down in round about the area of Stranraer, and particularly up in Perth, where the headquarters, again, just like golf, the rules of curling are established in Scotland.
Yes, it was interesting because my neighbours across the road, they're curlers. And, you know, once or twice a year, they go down to Stranraer for curling weekends. So obviously it's still very much the heart of curling.
Yeah, there was a good few of the two teams, the men and the women that came from Stranraer, and there was a big party going on in the curling club while they were waiting, excited, because of course they couldn't go across. It was a bit of a disappointment that they didn't get to go across and see them, because it was all held under lockdown in China.
So I think we've done very well, but we're still, why is it called curling?
Well, its other name, before we come to curling, is the roaring game.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's quite interesting. Why is it called the roaring game? We're talking about the ponds and the ponds freezing. When the ponds froze, they froze with little pebbles on the top of them as the ice froze. And so people would gather stones from the rivers. They'd all be different sizes, different weights, and they would throw them towards a target on the ice. And as the stones skidded across these little pebbles on the surface of the ice, they made a roaring noise. And it became the roaring game.
And actually, if you're in an indoor curling rink, you still get that roar of the stones nowadays, which look to be very, very smooth, but in fact they make the ice slightly rough, don't they?
Yeah, because they have a man in the ice rinks called the ice maker, and he has to not only freeze the ice, so it's a saline brine solution, and it's got pipes underneath it that freeze it. But then once it's frozen, he puts on water, he sprays water droplets on the top of it to give it this pebble-like surface, a bit like the peel of an orange.
Yeah, and that I think is quite fantastic, and that allows it to, I suppose, skate over the ice rather than...
Good Scottish word,
yes.
They kept that for the end, yes. Skate. You skate all your length if you don't have the proper shoes on, that's for sure.
I've done that a few times.
Yeah, so you took stones from rivers, but interestingly, that wherever there was weaving, like in Fife, where you've got the linen manufacture, they used to use the stones that were holding down the warp and the weft on the looms, and they would put a special handle of brass, they would fix onto it, and they'd keep the handle on the mantelpiece ready for when it froze next year.
Yeah, it makes you think, because one of the things when you've been up at the Crannog up in Loch Tay, haven't you, Liz?
I have,
yeah. Sadly burnt down, but some of the things they found under the loch at the sites of old Crannogs are stones with holes in them, which were used for all sorts of uses. So I wonder if even the very early years, people were skiting stones across the ice, and pretending to, maybe didn't use the word curling, but.
Well, I suppose in the days before Netflix and Amazon Prime, there wasn't a lot else to do. So skiting a stone seems as good as anything else.
Yes.
And Scots have taken the game all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, that it's now wherever you've got ice. So, you know, the countries that you might expect it, like North America, Canada, America, but also countries like Japan. I mean, Japan was they were the runners up. That's who the ladies beat 10-3 on Saturday morning. You wouldn't expect Japan to have curling, but it's all over Europe, all over the world.
But when you look at the weight of the stones as well, you know, Japan, they're much slighter in build, and they've all got to use the same stone. It's not like in what is it, 10-pin bowling, uh-huh. where you can choose the size of bowling ball you want to use. You have very, very strict rules surrounding the equipment in curling.
No, it's all very strictly set out by the World Curling Federation in Perth. And they lay down, just like the Royal and Ancient in St Andrews, they lay down the rules for the curling. They're called the Mother Club of Curling.
And, you know, talking about curling, one of the old clubs here, we talked about Kilsyth, but we've also got the Royal Caledonian Curling Club, which only became royal when Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were visiting Thun Palace as guests of the Earl of Mansfield. And they said to the Earl and Countess of Mansfield in the 1800s, what is this game curling that we keep hearing about in our little ventures up and round Scotland? So the Earl of Mansfield said, well, if you like, I can show you. It's probably easier to explain it. So they have a very long gallery in Scone Palace. So they put aside all the furniture and the carpets, rolled back the carpets, and got out the curling stones. And on this highly polished, beautiful wooden floor, they had a game of curling, skiting the stones up the floor, sliding them up the polished surface. And Prince Albert said, oh, I do think that looks a very interesting game. So the Earl of Mansfield gave him a present of 2 curling stones. History doesn't say whether they were ever used or not. But with that, Queen Victoria allowed the Caledonian Curling Club to use the title Royal Caledonian Curling Club.
I'm sure they came very useful as doorstops.
Doorstops, yeah. Oh, a lot of people use them as doorstops, don't they?
But the royals today are still very much followers of the games, because they were tweeting on their social media accounts congratulations and wishing the curling teams all the best as they went in to try and get our only medals of the games.
Well, they saved the day. The Scots did it again, didn't they? They saved the day.
So you said, Helen, what was the meaning? Where did it come, the name curling?
Uh-huh.
So maybe we should just talk about what the game is all about, what the rules of the game are. We've said that it's a game that's played on ice, and it's played with stones. Sometimes they're called rocks, but it has developed, like all the others, into a highly technical game. And the curling is the movement at an angle, curling in. If you throw it in the right way, then the curling stone will curl.
I don't think, Liz, we're really supposed to say throw it. I think we're supposed to slide it in a very controlled manner.
Well, when you see them doing it, the precision that they've got is fantastic. So for those that haven't seen it, it's played on an ice rink, on a sheet of ice, and it's played in lanes. And at the head of the lane, you have the house.
Which is like kind of a target, isn't it? A shooting target or a bow and arrow target.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like bowls, where you put the jack up, or bulls, but you mark a target of concentric circles on the ice, and the aim is to get your stones closest to the centre of the concentric circles. Mm. The button, as it's called, you want them on the button. So it's teams of 4, and each of the two teams, the opposing teams, have 2 stones each, so a total of 16 stones in all.
Yes, and what I found watching it was absolutely fascinating. I can't remember exactly which team it was, but one of the teams that were playing the men's, the British GB men's team, the skip of, I think it might have been Sweden, they came up and he did the most fantastic shot where he literally just, in other words, skited all the other stones off the target and got his one right in the middle.
Yeah, because it's very much a game of strategy. You know, when you watch it for the first time, you think, oh, it only really matters in the final few throws. But they're all laying it up. There's three shots that they can play. They can play a draw. And the purpose of that is to get it into the house itself and have it positioned well. They can play a guard, and that is sort of setting up the game ready to for the final ends where they're trying to protect theirs and to move other ones in. And then you've got the drive where they try and clear the lot.
And I think that was the drive. And even when it left his hand, the commentators were saying, let's see what happens here, because they thought this is really going to throw everything up in the air again. But
and they give you the stats for precision, and in the men's final, they were up in the high 90s for precision. I mean, it was really cat and mouse. It was a fantastic game that came right down to an extra end and the final throw of the, not the throw, the final stone. Of the extra end.
But even the measuring, when you see the two stones, you know, close to the button. It's not a case of the eye tells you which one's one. They actually have a very, it looks kind of an old-fashioned device, but it's almost like a compass where the point goes in the centre and a bit of string goes round to see which stone is nearer. But it's very precise.
Because, of course, the team gets points for the stones that are closest to the centre. So Eve Muirhead in the competition on Saturday, she had four at one end. That really put the hammer down. And talking of hammers, a very important part of the strategy is having what they call the hammer, because that's the last stone to be thrown. And of course, you've got a significant advantage with that. And so the hammer goes to the person who got a score in the last end, as it's called. And so you're trying to keep the hammer.
And it's really quite interesting just to sort of see, you know, how they work it all out. I think they must have great mathematical brilliance as well, thinking, you know, what am I going to do next? But not only is the stone a very important part of the equipment, but is also the brush.
Absolutely. It originated as a broom, a household broom. And the purpose of that is to sweep the ice, not just to clean it. If you sweep it and press down very vigorously, then you actually melt the ice and you can control the direction and the speed of the stone as it moves forward.
Yeah, and it's interesting just to hear them shouting. The skip at the far end is shouting, telling them, you know, what they must do with the brushes, when to sweep, direction change or whatever. You know, slow down, speed up, whatever. And it really is amazing. I would not like to have that responsibility of the to be brushing the winning stone to make sure I got that right. I would not like that responsibility.
Yeah, and of course, other equipment, they have to be able, while they're moving up and down the ice, they have to be able to slide, but also keep their balance. So they have two different shoes. One has got a very smooth surface to slide. The other one gives them grip. And I can remember, again, going back to my dad's day, you didn't have these special shoes in those days. You just put a sock over one foot.
But I think also if you're sort of not actually using your feet for doing the act of curling, you're just spectating, or it's not your turn. Some people still do put a sock over, because I've only been on the ice once with curling shoes on, and it really is a very odd sensation, one foot being kind of anchored and the other foot just having a free will to do what it likes on the ice.
Yeah, and they put grippers on nowadays so that the smooth shoe can get a grip when they're not sliding, they're not sweeping. But it's a game that has a great decorum to it. You know, if you, by accident, I was up when I was watching them, I was always thinking, what happens if one of them touches the stone while they're sweeping? And it's very much about a game of honour, that you have to declare a foul. If you were to touch it, then that stone would be taken out. So it's all about etiquette.
But the interesting thing, Liz, I was reading today that the curling stone, some of the people watching, if they watched the curling on television, the Olympic curling, they'll have seen lights on the stones. And this is all to do with these electronic gadgets that they now have in all sports events, that this was to show that if you do not release the stone when it's your turn to slide it up the ice, if you do not release it before the the line, what's it called, the line that the hog...
I can't remember. It's where the guardstones have got to go past. I can't remember what it's called.
If you don't release it before then, it's an illegal throw or an illegal shot. So what they had electronic devices built into the stone. They had electronic devices built into the underneath the ice. So a bit like the video call for footballs to see whether somebody's offside or not. Then these lights would go on. Green light meant it was fine and it was legal. A red light on the stone handle meant it was an illegal shot. But it was becoming so confusing to players and officials that they just abandoned it and said, we'll have what we've always had, somebody standing at the line watching. It's a bit like the long jumper. Has his foot gone on the mat or not?
I mean, these are games that are becoming so technical. While I was sitting watching it, I kept on wondering, it was the men that I noticed it with first, that they kept on looking. I didn't know if it was their watch or if it was their phone. I'm thinking, what are they looking at their phones for in the middle of? But nowadays, the whole thing is timed. It's a bit like golf when you have criticism for slow play. There's a certain allocation of time for the match and also for what's called thinking time. So, you know, they could stand all around all day discussing what they're going to do and where they're going to put it and how hard they're going to drive it, but they only get a total 38 minutes of thinking time for a 10-end game. And also, in addition, something new that I didn't know anything about, they have a timeout. So each team is allocated one timeout, and that is usually take it during the last few minutes of the game when they want to get their coach down. So they want to get either the coach or maybe the fifth member of the team who's sitting out, and they have a little confab to see what they're going to do. And that was essential when the men were playing, and it was that really close final.
Very tight, yes. Yeah.
So they had their timeouts then.
You know, it's a lovely game to watch. And when I'm watching it, I'm kind of thinking of all the other games that kind of come into it. Well, we talked about bowls and bulls, but, you know, I just thought hopscotch. Mm-hmm. You know, where you're pushing the peaver.
The peaver, yeah.
Up into the, having to be accurate with where you're wanting the peaver to land. So there's a lot of things come out, and you can understand how a game of curling could come out of just playing, throwing stones along ice, mm-hmm. sliding stones along ice.
And something else that was clear on Saturday when the Japanese ladies were, you know, Eve had got her four stones in and it was quite clear that they were defeated. The match doesn't just go on playing for the sake of playing. The tradition is that they'll concede.
Yes.
So the Japanese ladies conceded. And another thing which I think is really nice nowadays when you think of all the sports is that they don't allow you to over-celebrate.
Yes, I like that.
It's very much about good sportsmanship. You congratulate your opponents if they play a good shot or if there's very strong sweeping or anything like that. But you never cheer or, you know, sort of overzealous. At the end, there's a polite sort of fist pump or whatever, and that's the extent of it.
Do not whoop and jump for joy when your opponents make a mistake.
No, it's all
very much. Is it the spirit of curling it's referred to?
That's what it is. And afterwards, again, very social. They'll go for a drink together and the winners usually buy the drink. I don't know if that happened after the Olympics, right enough, but that's a tradition. Yeah. And I always remember there was a young lad that was on one of my tours that came across from the United States, and he was passionate about curling. And even before he came on the tour, he'd written to me asking if there was any possibility. Oh. And of course, it was the summer. So I searched around and none of the rinks were playing because it was the summertime. But I eventually got one in Edinburgh and they welcomed him. I can't remember what it was called, Caledonian or something. They welcomed him and they always exchange pins. Oh. So, and then they were very hospitable and looked after him while he was there. So very welcoming
that
sport.
Was lovely. That was lovely. But talk about you welcoming. What about the Bond Spiels?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a shindig.
Yeah, these were big outdoor events, traditionally outdoor events, held on the various lochs where literally thousands of players and hundreds of teams or clubs would arrive at a loch and have a great big open tournament.
Yeah, and they had to wait until the ice was a certain depth because they literally had bonfires burning on it, you know, thousands of people on the ice. Nowadays, we just don't have the climate to support that. And even when we do, I think the last one was 2010 and it was the Lake of Menteith and it was at a certain depth. They'd measured it. It was thick enough to hold a bonspiel. But then good old health and safety kicked in because the police said that they couldn't manage the crowds that were anticipated to turn up. So it didn't run in 2010 and we haven't had one. I don't know how. I can't. In living memory.
Yeah. But it was quite interesting talking about the crowds, and that was one of the reasons they cancelled it, was that their Cars Breck Loch, which is just outside Ochterarder in Perthshire, it was built specifically as a curling pond. You know, there was a loch there, but it was in the right place, it was of the right depth, so they turned it into a curling pond. And the reason it was so successful was it was alongside the railway. So they had a, what do you call it, not an invitation hall, you asked to be, to get off, a request stop there. So where they could have Bond Spiels there. And it from 1853 to 1935, they had 25 Bond Spiels there because the proximity to the railway made easy transportation. So there was no worry about icy roads or anything. The railways were new there, so people were very excited to get on them, but they had their Bond Spiels there.
Yeah, and although Scotland can't have them, I mean, we said that the Scots took it all over the world, there are huge Bond Spiels in North America.
Oh, yeah.
The largest outdoor Bond Spiel is in Winnipeg, Manitoba, on the Assiniboine River, I think it's called. And there's a huge outdoor Bond Spiel on the Lake Windermere in British Columbia, Canada. So curling has really been dominated by North America. And over the last couple of decades at the Olympics, it's been the Canadians that have been completely dominant.
Yes. Mind you, if you look at some of the temperatures that they're recording, even today in places like, you know, British Columbia and Saskatchewan, you sort of think, well, yes, we can understand you still being able to enjoy the outdoor Bond Spiels.
Yeah. No, so that was why it was so good to see Scotland leading the world again. But even if we can't lead the world in the actual sport itself, we still hold the right that the curling stones are produced in Scotland.
That's right. A tiny little island just in the Firth of Clyde on the west side of Scotland, which is only 2 miles in circumference and only rises over 1,000 feet. And that is the formed volcanic activity, and that's where the granite for the curling stones is quarried, but under license now because it's a nature reserve, a bird sanctuary.
Yeah, and it's one company that makes all the stones, isn't it, for the Olympics?
Yes, Kay's Curling Stones, they're the ones that have been, you know, passed. They've got the stamp of approval by the Olympic committees, and they only harvest, they call it harvesting the stone on Ailsa Craig, just as and when it's required. So it's not every day, it's not every year, it's just once in a while. I think the last time they got some stones there was something like, you know, 2015 or something. It was quite early on, and that will take them through for another 5 years or so.
Yeah. So it's nice to think that in these days of high tech, when they've got all these fancy measuring systems and coloured lights and all the rest of it. And even the brooms, you know, nowadays, I was looking at them, they are, you know, they obviously be very lightweight.
Carbon fibre.
You know, so very, very high tech. But still, the original origins, the curling stone itself, still comes from Bonnie Scotland.
And as they say, they get it, they store it until they need to use it. They're being very careful with the stone and the island. So, well, there's curling.
Yeah, well, a wee bonus there. And we were excited by it. I don't know if you're watching it. You might want to go back and watch it on iPlayer or whatever on the television. But well done to Eve Muirhead and the girls who brought us home our first gold medal of the Beijing Winter Olympics.
Yes, yes, sir. Not our first and only.
This is true.
I think it was the last day of the games we got it, wasn't
it? Leave it to the last minute, a bit of suspense. Yes. And we've had two words. We've had skite.
Yes.
And there was another one that came up there that I can't remember what it was.
A peaver. Yes.
Skite. So skite means to slide. Skite on your bahookie.
Yes, that's another word. It's your bottom.
And your peaver is what you play hopscotch with, which in our day, which you took an old...
shoe polish tin.
Yeah, what did you call it? Cherry black.
Cherry blossom. Shoe polish. Fill it with sand or something and
then smash it flat.
Yeah. And then the other one was a tobacco tin. In the days when pipe smoking was an acceptable thing to do, people would have tobacco tins, the same idea.
Before my time.
Oh, yes, of course it is, Liz.
Ta-ta for now.
Well, bye for now.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the loo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.